The title of the session today is A Christian Perspective on Diet Change. And the series, I'm doing two sessions today and then again tomorrow. And the title of the series is More with Less, Cooking with Whole Foods. My name is Betty Awney, and I come from Minnesota. I got interested in changing our diet. I grew up on a typical all-American diet of meat, potatoes, vegetables, and dessert, as most of us did, and most of us are still eating. When I became pregnant with Nathan, a friend gave me a book about food and the effect on the unborn baby, and that was the beginning of my search into the world of nutrition and food. And all that I have learned from books, from friends, from a couple of brief sessions that I've gone to, and from experimentation. I don't have any formal training in nutrition, and I don't regard myself as an expert in nutrition. But I do have a lot of enthusiasm for the changes that we've made in our family, and I'm very eager to share what that has meant for us and what I have learned through my experimenting, and that's what I want to share with you. I'm aware, or I'm sure, that many of you are doing similar things with your own families, and I hope that you will volunteer information or comments or questions about anything that I say. A lot of the things that I say are controversial, and you may have a different opinion, and please feel free to express that. Don't be afraid to disagree or to add something that I maybe don't know about the subject. Today we'll be talking about why change our diets, and specifically in relationship to our Christian life. And I will be talking about two areas: the responsibility we have to ourselves and the responsibility we have to others in relationship to diet. And I hope that I won't take too much time, so that there will be plenty of time for discussion on more practical matters pertaining to diet change at the end of the session. But I also hope that you will break in and ask questions as I go along. Tomorrow, I will be talking about vegetarian cooking. So, and that will be a more practical aspect: how do you go about not necessarily being a total vegetarian, but doing some vegetarian cooking. The first thing I'd like to do is to share with you some of the resources that have influenced me and have helped me in the kitchen. And I have them up, written down up here in case some of you would like to copy any of them, if you would like to buy them or look them up in a library sometime. The first books are available in the Holden bookstore, unless they've run out by now. I've been pushing these books for a week, so I don't know how many are left. More with Less is a book put out by the Mennonites, and it's a very good transition cookbook. If you're thinking about making some changes in your diet, but you don't want to do anything too drastic, this is a good basis. That there's a lot of good philosophy. A lot of the things that I have come to feel about diet change are written in this book. And the recipes are very good, and they try to make them so that they're easy to get used to if you're used to the typical American foods. So I recommend this as a good transition cookbook. If you're interested in vegetarian cooking, Diet for a Small Planet is a very good resource book and cookbook. It has many, many charts and tables about everything you could ever want to know about protein, and explains the rationale of not eating especially red meat, and why this makes a difference in the world food problem, and that's gone into great detail. There are also about two-thirds of the book is commentary, and about a third of it is recipes, or maybe it's the other way around, but there are some recipes. The recipes in this book, many of them are quite spicy. So if you don't care for really spicy foods, you may not like some of the dishes, but you may like to get the information from the book. I just found out about Laurel's Kitchen, this book, this spring, and it is a goal of mine. For anyone interested in diet change, in nutrition, in vegetarian cooking, it has just about all the information that a person would need to have, unless you're a scientist, you know, about it. And I have not tried the recipes yet because I just got the book, but they look delicious. They're all vegetarian dishes.
The recipes are great.
Good.
Yeah, I wanted to mention that they have something called better butter in there.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And,
I
ran into Laurel's Kitchen, where I live in California. The ladies, two of them, the authors were, they had their fresh homemade bread in the local bookstore. And got to meet them.
Oh, great. Yeah, bitter butter is a combination of safflower oil and butter, so that you're getting half the saturated fat that you would be getting if you ate butter or if you ate margarine, because margarine is hydrogenated fat, which is a type of saturated fat. So it's actually a really delicious way to, I mean, you get the taste of butter without getting all the cholesterol and fat in butter. So there's a recipe, a couple of recipes for it in here. You can just mix half and half, butter and safflower oil, maybe even sunflower oil, or you can make it be more stable at room temperature if you add a few other ingredients. Okay. Another book that I just got a hold of is The American Way of Life Need Not Be Hazardous to Your Health. And this is not just about nutrition, it's also about everything to do with a healthy lifestyle, physical fitness and managing stress and other things like that. But there is a chapter on diet, and it gives you a kind of a behavior mod type program for diet change in three phases. So they teach you a way of changing your diet over a period of 3 years that's very structured. So if you have a hard time getting yourself to do these things, a book like this might be helpful to you. This book is also available in the bookstore, The Supermarket Handbook. And this does a lot in teaching you about label reading and brand names, the kind of book you might just want to bring along with you when you go to the grocery store and look things up. And I haven't read this one yet either, but I think it's going to be a good handbook. The Living Temple is a book about the Christian responsibility relationship to diet. It does not have recipes in it. It's more a theory type book. And this, have I covered all the ones that are in? No. Cook Boldly is the Holden cookbook. And if you are enjoying the food in the dining room, you may like to get this book because some of those recipes should be in there. The dining room here tries to follow a similar philosophy that I will be describing today, in trying to provide nutritious foods and also ecologically responsible foods in the matter of not using a lot of meat, which is an inefficient way of using our Earth's resources. So it's a very good guideline, and I'm sure there's some good recipes in their book. Cooking with Conscience is a combination cookbook and philosophy of diet change. Midget Encyclopedia of Food and Nutrition is just an envelope filled with about four or five brochures with a lot of information about nutrition in a very condensed form. It costs $1. So if you'd like just some bare facts, basic facts about nutrition, you could purchase this envelope of brochures and have the beginning of some information. Then there are a few books. Well, The Living Temple, I don't think is available, the one I mentioned, in the Holden bookstore. Other books that are not, that I have not seen in the bookstore here are The Eater's Guide. And the only way I can tell you how to get this book is to come up afterwards and write down this address and order it, because I don't think it's available in an ordinary bookstore. But this is a very good, fun to read book on nutrition, and it's in very easy to understand language and just goes through the basic points of good nutrition. And then maybe the last third of the book, it has on shopping and menu planning, eating in a restaurant, wise choices in a restaurant. Then in the last part of the book has some recipes too. And the other book, two books I wanted to mention are Sugar Blues by Dufty, which if you're interested in the matter of sugar and how it affects your diet, you may want to read this book. If you do, you will probably never want to eat much sugar again. And The Vegetarian Epicure, I don't know the author, but that's a cookbook. And I don't have it, but friends of mine have said that it's just excellent. It has very fine recipes in it. So those are some things to get you started or to expand your library if you already have some of these books.
Yes. There's a cookbook that I just got in March, I think, and it's called The Moosewood Cookbook. And it's a large paperback one, and it's taken from a New York restaurant, and it's called The Moosewood Restaurant, and is strictly vegetarian also. Mm-hmm. And they substitute, they don't have any recipes, I think, for white sugar. It's all honey substitutes, and just really creatively illustrated also. And it's just, I mean, even to sit down and read it, although it's strictly a cookbook. And it's an interesting thing that they do. They have an index by foods, because they're big on using leftovers. No, not necessarily leftovers, but if you have a certain item in your refrigerator that you're trying to think of a use for, they have all different uses for broccoli or all different uses for cauliflower. And
that's a neat idea.
Yeah, it's unusual. I've never seen that.
The Moosewood Cookbook. The Moosewood Cookbook. Okay, enough about books. Well, what is wrong with the American diet? I've been telling you all we should change our diets, but what's wrong with what we're eating right now? Right now, two-thirds of the calories of the typical American diet come from partial processed foods, foods which are not in their natural form. The white flours, packaged meals, this sort of thing, where it's not in its whole form. The whole foods are those that are in their natural form, and partial foods are those which have been refined, processed, things have been taken out, things have been added, either additives, or they've added some of the nutrients back, but not all that were there in the first place. Two-thirds of our calories are coming from partial foods, processed foods. The Americans eat, the average American eats 120 pounds of sugar a year. That averages out to 2 cups a day. And probably most, we would all think, oh, I can't possibly be eating 2 cups a day. A lot of the sugar that we eat is so cleverly hidden, we don't even know we're eating it. So I'm sure we would all be surprised by the amount that we actually do eat. Teenagers average 3 cups a day. That's really mind-boggling when you think how much sugar teenagers are consuming, and most of that's coming from soda pop, or a good portion of that. Right now, Americans are getting 20% of the average. Now, a lot of people are changing, but the average is 20% of their calories from protein, 40% from fat, and 40% from carbohydrates. The dietary goals for the United States, which was a government study, which is very highly regarded in nutritionists, you know, among the nutritionists, feel that no more than 12% of our calories should be coming from protein, or we don't need any more than 12%. And some sources say even less. I read one, this book says, Farquhar here, says 8%. Up to 12% of our calories should come from protein, 30% of our calories from fat, and 58% of our calories should be coming from carbohydrates. Now, the problem here with the carbohydrates that people are eating now are refined carbohydrates, like white sugar, white flour, white rice. And when they say we should be eating 58% of our calories from carbohydrates, they're talking about unrefined carbohydrates. Whole wheat flour, brown rice, and this sort of thing, the legumes, fruits and vegetables. And so it's not just the number of calories difference, but the type of carbohydrate that we're eating. we're eating the wrong kinds of carbohydrates. So there's, our diet is not the best in the world, as many Americans think that it is. Does anybody have questions on that before I go on to comments? Okay, let's just talk for a few minutes about some of the diseases that are believed to be related, to, either proven to be or believed to be related to diet. The most obvious is obesity. 40% of Americans are overweight. And this is due to either too many calories in their diet or the calories are coming from the wrong foods. They're coming from too many fats, too many refined carbohydrates, sugar, white flour, that sort of thing. High blood pressure is related to sugar and caffeine and salt. Heart disease is related to the consumption of a lot of saturated fat. If too much fat is consumed, a fatty-like deposit forms on the arteries and you develop arteriosclerosis, and pretty soon the artery is blocked and the blood can't go through and you have a heart attack. That's partially due to diet. It's also due to other things like fitness and stress management and that sort of thing. Sugar also has an effect on heart disease in the fact that sugar, overconsumption of sugar increases the triglyceride level in the blood, which is related to heart disease. Cancer has some diet-related factors. Overconsumption of fats leads to a hormonal imbalance so that your immune system is weakened and you're more susceptible to certain types of cancer, especially of the breast and colon and uterus. Also, unrefined carbohydrates, overconsumption of unrefined, have been linked to cancer of the colon because the person is not getting enough fiber in his diet or her diet. When we've all heard about the additives that are, for example, sodium nitrite in such things as hot dogs and food colorings and saccharin. Another health-related problem that is affected by diet is stress. Coffee, tea, sugar, anything like that can affect your ability to deal with stress, and many of us use it as a way of dealing with stress when actually what it does is aggravate the problem rather than relieve it. And diabetes is related to overconsumption of sugar and, of course, indirectly through obesity, because overweight is, there's a very strong correlation between being overweight and developing the type of diabetes that you get later on in life. And we all know about the tooth and gum problems related to sugar consumption. And I could go on and on with diet-related health problems. But these are just a few of the major ones that come about because of what we're eating. Anybody want to comment on any of those diet-related health problems? Okay, well, what I said this was going to be a Christian perspective on diet change. What does being a Christian have to do with all this? My feeling is that we have a responsibility, that our Christian freedom, along with our Christian freedom, comes a responsibility to keep ourselves in the best health possible. There's a difference between the absence of disease and top quality health. And many of us may say, well, I eat all this stuff and I feel fine, I'm not sick, I don't have cancer or anything. But many of us may complain of fatigue, or we're just not at our very best, or we may die sooner than we might have if we'd eaten a better diet, or we may develop a disease later that was a very slowly developing disease that was partially caused by diet. And I think it's the responsibility of Christians to keep themselves, to make use of all that they've been given in the best way that they can, and so that they can fulfill their Christian commitments at the top of their potential, rather than just sort of sliding along saying, well, I'm getting by, but doing the most we can with what God has given us. And we read too about the body being the temple of the spirit. And even just out of respect for that, my feeling is that we need to respect our bodies and what we put in it. We don't put sand or water into the gas tank of our car, but we put all kinds of junk into our own precious bodies that are a gift of God. So my first and major point is that we have a responsibility to ourselves to be all that we can be. And we are what we eat, partially at least. So that's my feeling about the relationship between diet and responsibility to ourselves as Christians. The second reason or that diet is related to Christianity is our responsibility to others. And I'm mainly thinking about the world hunger problem. Probably many of you heard your parents say, or have you said to your own children, eat everything on your plate because think of all the starving children in India. And we all kind of laugh about that and think, well, there isn't, what's the relationship between what's on our plate and starving children in Cambodia or wherever? And I used to think there was no relationship. What, you know, if I don't eat it, it goes in the garbage. It doesn't go over to India. But indirectly, it can. If we make a real statement about it, it can make a difference, and that's what I'm going to try to prove to you now. A couple of small things. The processed foods that we're eating are wasting a lot of energy in producing and packaging, that energy that could be used for other things. We're spending more money on food than we need to. The processed foods are much more expensive than the whole foods. You can go and buy Cheerios for $1.12 a pound, or you can buy rolled oats for 30 cents a pound. It's an extreme difference. True, some of the things are more expensive, like fresh fruits are more expensive than canned fruits quite often. But in the long run, if you look at your total diet, if you're eating a whole foods diet, you're going to spend less on food. What can you do with the leftover money? You can support the Hunger Action Coalition, or you can send some of that money to a hunger-related agency so that it's being used in a better way. The main thing that we can change is our overconsumption of protein. Just imagine yourself sitting in a restaurant in front of a nice 8-ounce steak. The protein that went into making that 8-ounce steak could provide how many people do you think with a cup of cooked grain? How many people do you think we could feed with a cup of cooked grain with the protein that went into producing that 8-ounce steak? Anybody want to make a guess? It's 50. 50 people could have a cup of cooked grain for the amount of protein that went into feeding a steer to produce that 8-ounce steak. That's a lot of food that we are consuming. And livestock do eat food, most livestock eat food that could be eaten by humans. You may think, oh, well, the stuff they eat, we couldn't eat anyway. A lot of the livestock eat food that could be eaten by humans, and a lot of the land that is producing food for livestock could be producing food for people. So they're both ways of looking at that. So our consumption of beef is an inefficient use of the land. I'd like to just give you a few more examples so that you really understand the tremendous amount of protein that's being wasted on animals. 90% of the corn, barley, oats, and unexported soybeans in our country was fed to livestock. I don't have a year for that. It's in the 1970s. And in 1973, American livestock consumed the protein equivalent of 6 times the recommended protein allowance for our human population. They ate 6 times the amount of protein that all of our humans would need in our country. So a lot of protein going mainly to the livestock, cattle. An acre, if you take a 1 acre of land, if you put cereals grow cereals on that acre, it can produce 5 times more protein than the livestock can produce. If you put it into legumes, it can produce 10 times more protein. If you put it into leafy vegetables, it can produce 15 times more protein. And if you grow spinach on it, it can produce 26 times more protein. So a lot of land is being used up simply to produce, to get that all-American steak on the table for us and not for other people. Another interesting thing about this protein thing with livestock is that livestock, cattle do not have to eat protein foods in order to produce protein meat. They can eat a non-protein food, a waste product, like cellulose or some waste products from cocoa beans or something. They can eat that, it has no protein in it, and their bodies will change it and make a quality protein meat for us. So that, but that's not what the farmers are doing. They're not feeding their cattle non-protein foods. And why aren't they? Because if they feed them the high protein feed, the cattle will have a higher fat content. And the higher the fat content, the higher grade the beef is. So we are feeding our cattle high protein feed to make a high protein meat, which is very bad for our health, while people are starving. You know, the cycle just doesn't make too much sense. We'd be much better off eating a lower protein meat. I mean, a lower fat meat. And finally, about this protein subject, I think all of us think of the United States as the provider to poor countries for protein. We think we're sending them a lot of grain and food. We're sending food to the hungry. In reality, we send, or the poor countries of the world send us 1 million more metric tons a year of protein than we send them. That's the reality of it. We are importing more protein than we're exporting, and it's coming from the poor countries. Just one example, Costa Rica. I don't know the year for this, but in 1 year, their beef production went up 92%, and the consumption of their own people of beef went down 26%. Where was all that beef going? It was going to McDonald's or one of those places for us, for our hamburgers. So we are eating far more than our share of the world's protein. It's staggering when you start to think about it, when you read about it. Anybody have comments about that? Questions? I feel like I'm giving a sermon.
Just to support you, I just agree with what you're saying.
I was wondering, what are some other forms of protein that we're importing besides our
I think we're importing a lot of the grain that we're feeding our cattle. We're importing beef. We're importing beef from a lot of countries.
We're not supporting our own farmers.
Well, you know, it goes back and forth. But when you take, some of the grain that the cattle are eating is being produced in our own country, but we are importing some too. And I can't be more specific because I really don't know what the specific things are. Any other comments or questions?
Why is meat, very fatty meat, why is that considered a higher grade level than lean meat? Like you mentioned, the farmers.
I guess maybe somebody can help me, but I think it's because it's supposed to be more tender and more tasty, more and juicy.
Yeah. Well, the American consumer demands it.
Yeah, that's what they want.
They're putting the best meat on the market that you'll buy. If you want it. Less fatty meat, the farmer will certainly put less fatty meat on the market. As far as importing grain, I don't know, we have a grain glut in our country right now because we can't send it to other countries. They can't assimilate it. We grow plenty of food for the rest of the world, but the rest of the world can't handle it once we get it to their ports.
Yeah, that's the other, I really want to say something about the fact that diet change is not the total answer. I do think it's part of the answer. I think that by making a change in our own diets, we're making a statement a political and religious statement about what we think is right, as far as like we're eating our fair share of the protein, and we have no idea how our actions will be multiplied.
Mama,
you know, just think of the story of the 5 loaves and the 2 fishes, and how the disciples couldn't imagine how they were going to feed all those people. But we can't imagine how our actions can make any difference in the world. But then that's not up to us to figure out. We do what's right, and God takes over from there. So I really think, and I know personally that the changes that I have made in my diet have influenced other people. And maybe there are only a few people, but then they influence other people, and it just mushrooms. And so we have to start someplace, and I feel the place to start is with ourselves. But then the second thing we must do is take political action. Because like the fellow said back there, what good does it do to have more grain if it doesn't get to the people who need it? And I feel that we need to do whatever we can in our own situations to support political groups that are trying to make changes to eat more equally distribute food, whether you give money to an organization that's working on this, or whether you support a certain legislator who supports these measures in Congress, or however you do it. I think diet change is only one part of helping the world food shortage. It's one part, but the other part is a political thing that we have to do. So if they go together, and when people say, well, how is it going to make any difference? Those are my answers. You know, we can't imagine what difference we might make, but we also have to work on the political end of it too, so that things are more equalized. I'd like to just, go ahead.
I just wanted to say, I remember your comment about children and adults finishing what's on their plates, and the amount that we waste, too, is incredible. I remember when I was in college, they took a week's worth of leftovers on students' plates, and they put them in one of our glass display cases by food types, and it was just awful to see what is left on plates. And it's important that people start to realize that they shouldn't take more than they can eat, and if there are leftovers, to think of ways to use them creatively and not to throw them out. There's so many times I've been at friends' house and they just, oh well, that's not going to be around, so we'll just
throw it.
Yeah,
I don't think I throw anything away. I have two containers in my fridge at all times. One is cooking water that I've used. I don't use hardly any water when I cook vegetables, but whatever tiny bit there is goes in this jar from cooking potatoes or whatever, and I just keep adding to it. And then I have another container full of little bits and pieces of vegetables and pairings and whatever is any little things like that. And once a week or so, it all goes in a big pot and we have a delicious soup. I always used to think you had to have bones to start a soup. You couldn't make soup without soup bones. Well, we've had some fantastically delicious soups since I got into this cooking without much meat, just on the basis of vegetables and legumes and things like that. You were going to say something.
I just wanted to say, too, I think I've become more conscious of how gluttonous the American people are. I'm guilty, too.
We all are.
Finger, you know, but just the fact that, you know, we have to have so much at every meal, and we can't be satisfied with a sparser way of eating, mm-hmm. which I think eating a lot of times is a psychological thing as much as it is a physical thing.
And a routine
thing.
And
a social thing and a ritualistic.
Yes.
Right.
Like you said, because you changed your diet or your way of eating, you, other people have copied you and it'll spread. But then it'll have to more or less change our country, because, for instance, you still recommend drinking milk, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In order to have milk, we have to have cows. In order to have the cows give milk, they have to produce offspring to get the milk flowing. What are we going to do with all the offspring? So we have to change that way of living. Drop in all these calves. And then you say, for instance, in the school cafeterias, I have a friend that worked there for years, and we have dietitians that plan the meals, and she says most of it goes into the garbage because they don't want, to our teenagers, that is garbage. They want their hamburgers and things like that. They don't want the vegetables and the fruit. Some of them won't eat raisins then. It really has to change a lot of things in the whole country.
That's right. I'm not talking about some little change that's not going to make a big... If a lot of people change, it's going to change the whole structure of our economy. And I guess that what I'm saying is, let it happen. And there may be some confusing times, but I think we have to go through that until we can find how our country just has to figure out how they're going to do this. But you're right, it's going to mean some big changes. Yeah.
Getting back to this, a very legitimate question that she brought up, these calves, don't grain feed them. That takes care of that. Just let them be grass-fed, and then you don't have your non-fat meat.
Right, because they're not being... No.
And this is where the big crime comes in, why it starts. They're fed, well, like you pointed out, you could, in 8-ounce steak, I'm repeating, but so we can hear it again, you could feed 50 people. 50-1, that's quite a ratio.
What he's saying is that the cows that are raised for dairy production are not fed the same kind of diet that the ones that are raised for beef production are. Somebody over here.
Oh, I was just going to say that I think that there is change going on already. Like in my family, we eat considerably less beef, and a lot of my friends, you know, say, well, they have much more fish or a vegetarian meal once or twice a week or poultry. So I think it's already happening.
Actually, Americans are being forced to change because of the economy and the price of beef. And I guess in a way that's a good thing, but hopefully people will not just do it for as long as it's economically sound, and then as soon as the beef price goes down, go back to their previous diet. But a lot of people are changing not only because of the economy, but also because of what we're learning about health and its relationship to diet. So I think, I'm sure all of you have made some...
dealt with diet and economy. And it is true that people are spending less on groceries, but they're not spending it in the correct way. Like they're spending it on macaroni and spaghetti and still buying the luxury items like Stereos. And, you know, they're just, they're cutting back on their food, but not on the luxury.
Yeah.
Well, it is, there are statistics that Seventh-day Adventists who do not eat meat live longer, maybe 7 to 10 years longer. But then the people in India, and I don't mean the poor people, I mean the ones who could afford beef but don't, I don't think they have that long a longevity. And they're vegetarian. I don't know what we're really proved by that.
Well, a vegetarian that's eating a balanced diet, they've done studies on them, and I just wanted to point out some information I have about that, that they have, what you said, they live longer. I think they get their first heart attack 10 years after the national average, vegetarians. These are American vegetarians, no, I don't know about Indian. They have a lower cholesterol and lower triglyceride level in their blood, even if they're eating eggs. It seems that if you're a vegetarian, you can get by with eating more eggs than if you eat meat. They have a lower incidence of high blood pressure. They have a lower incidence of many types of cancers. They have fewer bowel problems, like diverticulosis, and they have a capacity for greater physical endurance. So the vegetarians are not suffering by any means. They're better off than we are. Yes?
That's probably no fish and no seafood.
Yes, this study is including vegetarians that they're eating dairy products, but not fish or poultry or beef. And that's a personal choice that each family has to make. You know, do I want to give up meat entirely, or do I want to just cut down on it? and go more with more fish and poultry. Fish and poultry is, fish is a very efficient, or very good form of protein. It's very low fat, low calories, and a pure, very pure protein, complete protein. So if you're choosing not to be go completely vegetarian, then you should increase the fish and poultry and decrease the beef.
I didn't realize that as a vegetarian, things like, I just found out lately, like mushrooms and sprouts and things like that have a great deal of protein value in them. And because I always thought it was just the cheeses and the milk products mm-hmm. that you could gain your protein from. But there is a great deal of protein in some of the things that I never thought were
yeah. People have a lot of misconceptions about where the protein is. And tomorrow I will be going through the different sources of protein and how to combine different foods to get complete proteins mm-hmm. and talk about, you know, try to encourage you to try more vegetarian cooking because it's much easier than you think it is. I used to be very afraid that when I decreased the amount of meat we ate that my children would not have, their blood would be low in iron or the hemoglobin count would be low or something. And I'd take them to the doctor for blood tests every once in a while, and he'd say, oh, I've never seen such a high hemoglobin level in a little child before. What do you feed this kid? You know, and then I quit worrying because I found out it's very easy to do if you just learn a few basic facts, and that's what I will deal with tomorrow, the vegetarian cooking. Any other comments or questions?
Yes. You mentioned the eating with a Christian aspect. Do you have, or any of those books in reference to that topic?
Yes. The books that deal with that the most are The Living Temple. Oh. It's not a cookbook. The More with Less cookbook. And Cooking with Conscience. And the Holden cookbook, Cook Boldly, has a short statement at the beginning about that.
I was thinking of Our Ladies group at church who meets, you know, weekly in
yeah.
various books that might be interesting.
They would be
which of those books, one book, would you think might interest a group of that nature?
Depends on how much time you wanted to take. If you wanted to make it a major study, you might want to take The Living Temple and read the whole book. Mm-hmm. If they're more interested in the practical aspect, maybe More with Less would be a good one. Because it talks about, you know, how to do it in your diet, and I guess those. I have not read Cooking with Conscience. I just saw it, found it here at Holden, and you may want to look at that because that might be a good book to use for that. I don't know if it's from the Christian point of view or if it's more humanitarian. Mm-hmm. I haven't read it.
There's another one called Freedom from Fat, and it's by a lady who was very overweight, and it's a very Christian viewpoint. That it's written with, and she finds her answer in scripture and her strength there, and it's a short paperback, doesn't take much time at all to read really. And I can't remember her name.
The World Hunger and so on.
Okay. Yeah, but I believe it is called Freedom from Fat.
There are other books that don't deal specifically just with diet, but with a lot of things to do with hunger, like Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger is one book. Do you have some others you want to suggest?
Not particular. I was just going to add on to your comments about the More with Less cookbook. That book is just spotted and stained to death in my kitchen. I just cannot recommend it more highly. She not only gives you millions of excellent recipes, but the introduction to each section is just sort of a synopsis of everything that's really been written, both from the political and the economic and the Christian standpoint. And
I'm thinking of my son who's eating Cheerios, Rice Krispies, and peanut butter sandwiches for 4 days here. Probably live on for quite a while, you know, at home.
Well, if he's eating a peanut butter sandwich and a glass of milk, he's getting a very good, complete protein. Mm-hmm. But this is peanut butter they make right here, and yeah. It doesn't have any sugar in it or salt, and it's a... Mm-hmm. That's a good food, although, you know, he's not getting all the vitamins and minerals he needs without any vegetables.
Well, an occasional apple or a cherry.
Yeah. Could something be done so that the food manufacturers don't put sugar into ketchup and
I think if we refuse to buy it, eventually they won't make it anymore because nobody's buying it. And if you make your own ketchup, there's a recipe in Laurel's Kitchen for homemade ketchup. Also, make your own salad dressing. Yeah. Salad dressings is one of the worst sources of fat and sugar, too, in our diets. And we don't realize when we pour that tablespoon or two over our salad how many calories we're getting and how little food value. Practically none.
Besides, it tastes better if you make your own.
Right.
I was going to say, just things like canned fruits. I only buy the canned fruits for my, especially for my boys, that are packed in water or a juice pack with absolutely no sugar. And if you try and buy those brands, whether Featherweight or what are they called? Mm-hmm. Anyway, you see, they're all in the special dietetic section. You really have to ferret them out. Any of the other canned fruits that you buy have so much sugar and syrup.
They just about destroy the value of the fruit.
They do.
The ones in heavy syrup
are. And of course, then if you try and pour off the fruit, the juice, thinking you saved yourself from the sugar, what you've done is poured off most of the nutrients because that's the juice the fruit's been cooked in. So you really can't win with the canned fruits. And they're much more expensive to buy in water pack, but I think some of the big fruit companies are beginning to catch on and offer something sort of timidly on the shelf.
It's easy to get inexpensively pineapple cooked in its own juice because Dole and Del Monte make it. Libby's makes a whole line of fruits in juices, but the only trouble is that Libby's is a Nestle's company and many of us are boycotting Libby's. So it is hard to find canned fruits in their own juices, but you're much better off buying the fresh fruits that are in season anyway.
Sure.
So
I was just saying as an example of consumerism, if people started buying this brand like mad and refused to buy the sugared stuff, you'd bet that some of the major companies would start producing what the consumer wanted. We have a very powerful voice. Well,
the political angle works too. I'm a pediatrician, and in baby food, it was loaded with salt and sugar and so on. And they've really done a good job at eliminating the salt, just from a modest public outcry and a lot of political pressure put on by. In this case, physicians, but I can't recommend highly enough the value of the political pressure. All you need is a couple of Time magazine articles or something on the value of water pack stuff rather than sugar pack, and people start to ask the question, and it begins to hit the pocketbook of the manufacturer right off the bat. So.
Could be a good project for a group, a church group, to try to get their senator to do something or however they wanted to go about trying to make a change or hook up with a group that's already working on it and support what they're doing. You learn a lot in the process and you could possibly actually make an effective change.
60 Minutes always does a good job.
Oh, right.
I've heard about Betty Crocker's Chemical Kitchens, and I wanted to write a letter to 60 Minutes and say, is this true? Would you do a feature?
Yeah, just write a letter to 60 Minutes and ask them to do a story.
You're asked, too, if the word is is infiltrating on appropriate eating. And I should tell you of an incident that happened to me last night up at the hospital. A couple of kids came up, a 9-year-old and a couple others, with some slivers. And I was telling them how to soak them out with a saline solution. And the girl said, salt? And she said, don't you know you're not supposed to eat salt or fat or sugar?
Do you know where
Riedel,
I was
and Riedel
yesterday?
And Riedel had all nodded,
I was over in Narnia yesterday. They must have gotten that a little overzealous about
it. And I said, I could use you in my office. I say this, I'm drying the mouth.
Oh, that's funny. Did you get the slivers though?
Well, we set it all up for them to soak them out overnight, and they failed to come and pick up the materials that were set out for them.
But I'd like them for my own son. Just cut slivers off.
Incidentally, if you're interested, you don't have to dig slivers out. You can soak them out overnight.
You mean keep your hands
in the saline
solution? No. Like, the reason I get involved in this is that I got a fissure from my finger yesterday, and I had to do a little surgery for that. And it's bound to get infected because it was in for, you know, 5 or 6 hours till I got back here. And so you just take 3 tablespoons of salt and a quart of water, or, you know, it's not crucial the exact amount, but somewhere around that amount. And wet a towel and wrap up the part and put a plastic bag over it and a sock over that so you can pin it to your sleeve or pant leg or whatever. And let it soak for 12 hours and it osmotically draws all the fluids out, the bacteria, the wood particles, and so on. It's an excellent preventive if you step on a nail or if you get an infected insect bite.
You can do that with putting Hexol on a piece of cotton too and clean that over if the swelling.
As long as you can exclude air from it.
I have a comment about legislation. I was in a movement this spring on some public education legislation. And I was amazed at what letters and calls to our lawmakers, what influence they make. I used to be the type of person that would sit back and say, well, I'll write a letter about this or whatever. But then it either didn't get done or I would put it off. And once in a while I would get one written. But I think if each one of us took the time to write a letter, and you can write it in longhand on a piece of cardboard or whatever, but get it to your senators and your legislators. And if you have concerns, they want to be reinstated into the legislative or whatever judicial body they belong to or they are in at that present time. They want to please us as constituents, and they're going to look into the issues that we send to them. And I can't believe the power that we have on our lobby.
We don't make use of time. We don't make use of all the power that we do have.
So if we each went home and wrote a letter to a lawmaker in our area about either food consumption or whatever we wanted to talk about, I think they would start at least thinking about it in the years to come. I think it would influence them.
Yeah,
I think it would be more effective to write to the manufacturer of that food and tell them we're going to fly it anymore. You have a lot quicker action than you will through a political ring around in Washington.
That's how we got the salt out of baby food.
If you're going to boycott a product, write to the company and tell them that you are and why. Yeah. You probably get an interesting answer too. But that is effective.
Just tell them you aren't going to buy their product anymore until they change. Mm-hmm. They get enough letters, they're going to change. It gets them right out of their pocketbook.
If you want to see people's attitudes of food, listen to the reception to the meatloaf tonight versus the borscht and the lentil soup in the last day or two. Just listen to the complaints that, oh, this is something. People's attitudes, I've never seen this before. What is this stuff? Gee, it looks funny. I think attitude is really an important thing, and I think we let it get to a stage where we can't do very much about it. We don't start with our children. Mm-hmm. You know, it's real easy for a kid to shove something away. Well, how do you know you don't like it? Yeah, or no, it just doesn't look good. Well, could you describe good to me? Well, I don't know, but that doesn't look good.
One thing about the children, and I've had to go through this with my own son because I began to change our diet after he had already established his eating pattern. And he was eating hot dogs and Wonder Bread and all that stuff. And it has to be a gradual change. And what I do with the things that I make is, for a couple of examples, if I make a favorite food of my children's, and I'll change one ingredient in it to make it more nutritious, then the next time I make that food, I'll change another ingredient in it. For example, I'll go from white macaroni to whole wheat macaroni. Then the next time, I'll add some kidney beans to it, or I'll take out some of the meat and put bulgur in place or something. So you don't just all of a sudden place this weird-looking dish in front of your children when they're not used to it. It has to be a gradual thing, I think.
If I could take exception with that, people in this country have been spoiled to think that they have the right, that it's a God-given right to choose what they eat. And I think that's a real mistake. This is part of the me country. This country has always had enough, and you could demand what you wanted. If you wanted a 16-ounce steak, by God, if you had the money, you could have a 16-ounce steak. Mm-hmm. I think that time is rapidly drawing to a close. And The reason I would take exception with your method, I think it's a practical one that you suggest, is that other food and its whatever whole, completely the way you end up with this final product, there's nothing wrong with that. And I don't see a reason why it can't just be presented straight out as this is a viable, reasonable thing to eat. It's not going to kill you. And it is what it is. And whether you like it or not, there are people around the world that are eating that or less.
I agree with you in theory, and I haven't thought about it exactly that way. I guess I found that people who decide one day I'm going to change my diet and they drastically change their diet, all of a sudden don't last very long. And they go back to the way they were eating before. Whereas people who make a gradual change seem to stick with it. And so I really think that what you're saying is the way that I wish human beings could do it. But I guess I'm realistic enough to think that I'm not sure that some would stick with it. Unless they're really, they have to be really committed.
Oh, I don't mean change your whole diet in one day. I mean, here's a dish and it's whole wheat macaroni with this, that, and the other. And it's not boxed.
Well, I do that too with my kids. And if I do that, I usually have some other favorite in part of the day so that they don't feel that they're, you know, have a sort of a negative attitude towards it. That they can feel positive about the meal if it's their favorite that I made with the lentil soup or whatever.
Do you feed your children vitamins?
I have been, because our water was from a well and I was concerned about the fluoride. Since then, now I've gotten worried maybe I shouldn't be giving them fluoride. Well, I don't know. I do because my older child, who grew up without a lot of these things, is quite choosy about the vegetables that he will eat. And I always expect him to try everything that is on the table. But if he won't eat very much of it, so I do supplement. But I think if a child, now my younger one eats everything that's presented, and I don't feel that he needs vitamins.
What do you think of Dr. Atkins' diet, where he mentions that it's impossible to receive all your vitamins and minerals through the food you eat, that you have to supplement with vitamins and minerals? Do you agree with that?
I don't agree. It would, unless you have a typical American diet, then maybe you aren't.
But if
you're eating a good diet, yes.
I have a background in nutrition. I have a degree in home economics. And my nutrition teacher pounded into us, if you eat a proper, well-balanced meal with all the vegetables, fruits, everything, you don't need any vitamins. You don't. You know, you can get it all.
The point that I wanted to raise in regard to that, which I agree solidly with you, is that so many Americans, you know, take such an excess of vitamins, and it is actually detrimental and can shorten their lives. Yeah. And I'd like to urge you to be careful about your vitamin intake.
I would just like to close the session by saying that for me, this exploration into the whole foods has been an exciting one, and I've learned to enjoy cooking, and I've learned to enjoy so many more foods than I used to, and I do not feel that I am deprived at all by the change that I've made in my diet. In fact, I feel that I have a much richer, not in the sense of fats, but a much richer diet now than I had before, and it's not a sacrifice. It's more with less.